of uprisings that is very important to me. I wrote a book about it, The Asian Wave, from 1986 to 1992. In 6 years, in 8 countries, 9 dictatorships were overthrown. These global waves of uprisings go back to 1848, 1905, 1917, and 1968. 1968 was a world historic year that changed the planet's culture globally. After 1968, the movements in France in May 68, the Black Panthers, the student strike in the United States in May 70, the movement in Czechoslovakia, Mexico, India, China, Argentina, in the first world, the second world, the third world, the global culture changed. We are here in large part because of these movements of 1968. After 1968, there have been at least 5 other major times of global upheaval. The disarmament movement of the 1980s, in which millions of people mobilized for an end to the Cold War, helped to bring about an end to the Cold War. Gorbachev said later he was convinced by the disarmament movement in Germany in particular that Germany would not invade Russia again, and they didn't need the buffer states between Germany and Russia. So this disarmament movement helped to change history. The East Asian uprisings, which I will come back to, the revolts against the Soviet regimes, which were influenced by the East Asian uprisings, the alter-globalization wave from the Zapatista uprising in 1994, which we all know about, through Seattle in 1999, until February 15, 2003, when as many as 30 million people went into the streets on the same day without centralized organization. And then, of course, the 5th major time of global upheaval is the Arab Spring of 2011, the Indignados Occupy Wall Street movement. The time gap between these global waves of uprisings is shorter and shorter. The intensity of global solidarity, what I call the Eros effect, is more and more intense. And the movements are more similar to each other. Today in the world, the following are the characteristics of movements on every continent. 1, autonomy, that is that political parties are not leading them. They're independent, they're autonomous. 2, the movements internally use direct democracy as the means of making decisions. 3, solidarity internationally is common to all of these movements, whether it's the Arab Spring, the Zapatistas, all of the movements in the world today share that characteristic. And finally, direct action is a characteristic that unites all these movements. So what we have in our plurality of movements in the world, if we boil it down and look at the essence of these movements, is a very similar global movement. And this global movement will increasingly erupt in waves of global uprisings. The question that I would like to ask is, how can we make use of these waves? Now, that's a question for us to discuss. I have some answers, but I just want to talk about this Asian wave, which overthrew 9 dictatorships. And the Gwangju uprising in South Korea in 1980 was a 20th century Paris Commune. Why don't we know about it? Why don't you know about it? I know about it. I live in Gwangju. But it was a time when the people of South Korea were tired of military dictatorships imposed by the United States. The army was sent from the front lines of the demilitarized zone, that is the line between North and South Korea, into Gwangju. They beat people. They raped women. They killed students. They killed taxi drivers who tried to bring the students to the hospital. They arrested the police chief because he wouldn't order his policemen to open fire. They arrested the commander of the local army because he wouldn't order his men to fire. The people defeated thousands of paratroopers in hand-to-hand fighting, led by the city's transportation workers, bus drivers, and taxi drivers who drove a column of buses. They captured machine guns, mounted the machine guns, and ruled the city for 5 days through direct democratic assemblies while fighting was going on the outskirts of Korea. Gwangju inspired the movement for South Korean democracy, which won 7 years later. But there was a wave that Gwangju inspired. The Philippines in 86, Ferdinand Marcos, longtime dictator, was ousted. South Korea, 87. Burma, 88. Thousands died, but they overthrew two dictatorships before a third dictatorship massacred thousands. China and Tibet in 89. Bangladesh, Nepal, and Taiwan in 1990, and Thailand in 92, all overthrew dictatorships. This was a remarkable wave. So if we compare it with the Arab Spring, just to come back to what I said, the global waves are increasing in intensity, and the time between the various uprisings happening is decreasing. This is a direct result of the internet. This is something the internet has done, and something we can look forward to seeing happening in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Richard Freeman.
You know, through the revolutions come in waves. And I'm an old man, so I participated already in three waves of revolutions. Because the first of my childhood was the revolution of 1956 of workers' councils against Hungary, against the communist tyranny, which was really, as we now know, a form of bureaucratic capitalism. And the idea that people would organize against communism in the name of Soviets, that is to say workers' councils, was a new idea in 1956, because it made us realize that it was really one world. And then 68 came along, and I was active in the occupations that took place at the university where I was teaching, Columbia in New York, and then came over to France and so on. This was a worldwide revolution. And since then, we've had a wave of revolutions in Southeast Asia, a wave of revolutions in Latin America, and of course the most recent one is the one that happened here in the Arab Spring. But now, I know that a lot of people are feeling disappointed because the Arab Spring, although it spread a lot and inspired revolts and in Europe, even in the United States, where they took over the State House of Wisconsin, and where I was able to say that the Arabs have taught democracy to the Americans instead of the other way around. But now we're in the part. A wave goes up, and now we're in this part of the wave. And a lot of people are discouraged. But we must celebrate the victory of Tunisia and a partial victory in Morocco, because we're here now. And the idea that we revolutionaries can get together and plan for future revolutions here in Tunisia, a terrible dictatorship of torture and so on. No, it hasn't all gone away. Although I was brought here by a taxi driver, and I asked him what his profession was. And he said that he was a policeman, a part of the CRS, that's the anti-riot police. And he said he quit in 1912. I asked him why. He said he was against torture. So you see, something fundamental has changed. People change. And of course, the old forms of organization, the authorities sneak back in. They call themselves different things. They paint themselves Democrats or one thing or the other, because they sneak back into power. And it seems that the people are silent, but it's not true. So my first message is that don't get discouraged. All revolutions are doomed to failure, except the last one. Okay, now the last one has got to be, and I think we all can agree on this in a minute, worldwide. As long as the capitalists have a base in order to organize armed counter-revolution, as long as the military power of the United States in particular maintains itself everywhere, clearly, we're not going to triumph. The internet, on the other hand, the World Wide Web, to be specific, is a form of organization which permits that 99% of the people of the world
that is to say, the 8 billion, to overthrow a regime of 400 billionaires, because that's what the economists tell us. Half the world is owned by 400 billionaires. So it's billions versus billionaires. Now, what I want to do in the few minutes that I've got your attention is to review the history of revolutions from the beginning in terms of communications technology, because that's our subject, internet and revolution, okay? The first great revolution was the revolt of Spartacus of the slaves in ancient Rome. And they were tough. They took over about a third of Italy. They beat the Roman legions that had beaten every professional army of every other empire in the world. But eventually they were crushed. Why? The Romans had Roman roads. They had a network. They had a communications network. And on those Roman roads that they built everywhere they conquered, they rushed in troops from North Africa, from Spain, and from other parts of their empire. And eventually they were able to crush and crucify all of these revolted slaves. Okay? So we now know that the network is very, very important. Let's jump ahead now to the 18th century. The 18th century was a great time of democratic revolutions, the first republic in the United States and then the second one in France 10 years later. How did they get organized? In both cases, they had committees of correspondence. That is to say, the roads, the post office, and so on, enabled people to correspond so that they knew what was happening in every part of the country, and the revolutionaries could get together, communications technology. Better still than that, they had presses that they could use. And so Thomas Paine in the United States, whose slogan was, "The world is my country," wrote Common Sense. And it turns out that every person in the United States above the age of 18, either read it or heard it read, because everybody doesn't have to be literate. Not only and everybody doesn't have to have a computer for the message to get around. The same in France. You had Marat, the friend of the people, and his blogs made governments fall and reputations and so on. So that's a great step in technology. 50 years later, we had the first international revolution and the first revolution where the working people appeared on the scene under their own flag, of course, the red flag. And these were the revolutions of 1848. And they were facilitated, it started in Paris, but then it went to Berlin, and then it went to Vienna, and it went to Potsdam, and all these different places. It was just like the Arab Spring. They didn't have the internet, but guess what they had? They had the telegraph. First, the mechanical telegraph, which was just a bunch of towers on hills where they could send messages in code, but also the electric telegraph. So this was a great era of a Europe-wide revolution. In that revolution came forward the slogan, "Working people of all lands, unite." Of all lands. And they formed the organization called the International. Actually, that was formed a little bit before. And the International was a way that people all over the world could confederate and send delegates and organize together to support each other's strikes. And the first worldwide strike was for the 8-hour day, something that we lost in most of the countries of the world because these struggles have to be fought and then fought again and then fought again. And because as long as capital remains centralized and able to dominate, there's no way for victories to be too permanent. Okay, now let's move forward to the big era of international socialism with thousands of newspapers and so on all over. But something else appeared on the world, and that was broadcasting. Okay, the 20th century is the century of totalitarianism. It's the century of hierarchical, top-down broadcasting. Instead of all the little radio stations that began to spring up in the 20s, they organized them into networks, made top-down networks like CBS network and so on. And of course, in Germany and Russia, it was just the government had the network. And so it was one voice, Hitler's voice, Churchill's voice, Roosevelt's voice, De Gaulle's voice, Stalin's voice, beaming down, and everybody was like, you know, Orwell's 1984, where actually they still have that in China, televisions that look back, so that if you're a teacher in a room in China, the authorities know what you're telling the students. So broadcasting was definitely not a step forward for organizing revolution, and to get rid of it. But now we have something different, and that is the internet. The internet, the net tells us all about it. It's like the women's tradition of networks, of the quilts that are made. It's a way that is bottom up, that is fundamentally democratic, that enables people as equals to come together, to share information, to make decisions, and to act together in real time. And that's exactly what happened with the Arab Spring. Now, around 1987, I developed a theory, because everybody was saying another world is possible. Now, I'm an old man, and I'm also an historian, and I was asking the question, is another world really possible? How much time do we have? The capitalist world is like a ship, okay? And in this ship, the dictators and the billionaires have taken over the bridge. And just, they're not interested in steering it. They're steering it straight onto the rocks of total destruction through the ecology, through the weather destroying, and governments that are becoming so security conscious that freedom is quashed, wars that are taking place all over and being financed everywhere and so on. Very clearly that if we can keep on going this way, a lot of you will not be able to live to be my age. And I would bet that I'm an optimist. I would give us one chance in 100 to survive this hellish century that has started in so many wars, okay? Now, if there is one chance in 100, what is it? Okay. On this ship, which we call planet Spaceship Earth, the workers, their families, the crew, are all down below decks. They're all sealed into compartments called nationalities and religions and all these different ways that the bosses on top keep us separated. And meanwhile, they're not steering the ship. They're busy pillaging all the stuff that's on board and eating it because they know there's going to be no tomorrow. Now, how can we all get together and storm the bridge, swarm them, throw them overboard, and get the ship back on course? Well, they say that Archimedes, that wonderful old philosopher, had a theory. It was a thought experiment. I'd like you to join me in a thought experiment. He said, if you give me a lever long enough, okay, and a fulcrum, something to balance it on, and a place to stand, I could lift the world. Well, you know, that's theoretically possible, if there were a lever that could be that long, and if there were a place to stand. Now, in our case of trying to swarm the bridge of Spaceship Earth and take over, we have those things. The lever is international solidarity. But it has to be long enough to include the working people of all countries, okay? Now, we also have a fulcrum. And that fulcrum I'm going to call planetary consciousness. Now, I don't mean anything too big and philosophical about it on the first level. Planetary consciousness is simply this. We all know that we live on a planet. When I was growing up, that's before World War II, 90% of the people did not know that the Earth was a planet. Most of the people didn't even know that there was much beyond the next village. And I'm talking about France, where people went to the next village to find a husband or a wife, and Paris was something that was, who called you up and made you pay taxes, okay? But when we talk about all the countries in Asia and Africa and Latin America, most of the people had never heard of the other countries, had never heard of the world, until World War II. And then suddenly there were GIs everywhere, and Japanese swarming over Asia and so on, airplanes coming in, and a little later, radios and transistor radios. And suddenly everybody knew, because it was a world war, wait a minute, there's something big out there, and it's nasty. Because the big news was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the very people, the billions at that time, and there were only 300 billion of us then, we discovered at the one and the same time that there is a world, that we live on it, and that they can destroy it. They can blow it up. Okay? So that is what I call planetary consciousness. That you can make it nice and mystical, and that the world is the absolute, and it's the only thing we have, and there is no planet B, and that we love it, and so on. And I think all of that is true. But I'm not talking idealism here. I'm simply talking facts. We now live in one world, and everybody knows it, and everybody that isn't looking away knows that the only solution to the problems will be a global, a planetary solution. Now, fortunately, we have the platform. For the first time, we have a place to stand. Now, in the earlier days, when there were steamships and airplanes, people could get together for meetings like this and so on. But now we can communicate, and we can organize such meetings by the internet. Now, with the social media that made this Arab Spring flash across North Africa, and then across the Mediterranean, and then over to the United States and so on, there's no reason why this wouldn't happen next Thursday and become worldwide. Who knows what horrible incident on the planet, or what horrible thing of a political repression will get people to come out into the streets and to communicate with each other. And so there is an answer to the question. Yes, another world is possible, but it can only be possible when it comes from the bottom up, and when the 99% move together. And when I say the 99%, the majority in that are the women of the world. They are the ones that do, you talk about the labor movement, and that's where I come from, women do most of the work in the world. I'm talking about the work that's either paid for or in the informal sector, okay? They feed the world in most of the third world, and they do a lot of the work in the factories. And then they come home and they reproduce the family, which is what the capitalists chew up as labor, to make more profits. So it has to be a worldwide revolution. It has to be a revolution where women's rights come before the revolution and not as something that is promised afterwards and never comes. So the answer is yes, but the chances are slim. So what we need to ask ourselves is, how can we better use the internet, which is a weapon that was created, yes, I know, partly by the military, and is used to spy on us and so on. But you know, something, the Hill, we spied on us. When I was young, they opened my mail and they listened to my telephone conversations. So, and what I love about it is that they have a billion calls and no one who speaks Arabic in the CIA. So let them keep collecting the data. I don't give a damn. They'll never come.
About the revolutionary role and importance of internet in Morocco, and but before that, I have to inform you that last week, a friend of mine named Hisham Mansouri was arrested by 9 policemen with plain clothes, and because he is an activist of civil society and he is the director, executive director of the Moroccan Association for Investigative Journalism. And he was accused officially through a press release by the government of Rabat, through the official agency, MAP in Morocco. He was accused of organizing a prostitution place. And these are the means of Ben Ali regime. So I would like that you speak about this case, violation of human rights, and that Hisham Mansouri, my friend, he is today, in prison.
So I will speak about this revolutionary role of internet in Morocco through two realities and two events, just 5 minutes. Until 2005, until before, if you want, the era of internet in Morocco, the state media controlled 95% of the flow of information in Morocco. 95%, because the broadcasting media are really dominating in Morocco, and the broadcasting media are dominated by state. They aren't really public media, but they are state media. But today, this broadcasting media control less than 50%. So in about 10 years, the state, lost the half of its control of the information disseminated in the country. And today, the first media is an electronic site, not the Moroccan state television. The second fact that the time between uprisings we had, since independence of Morocco, we had a lot of popular uprising. But now time between uprisings is more and more sharply, decreased. It decreased sharply. Before, in the 60s, 70s, there was 15 years between an uprising and another. For example, the first one took place in 65, the second one in 81, and the third one was in 2011. So we had about 15 years. Today is between 1 and 2, 3 years. For example, the popular uprising in Sidi Ifni took place in 2007. The Safro is another town uprising, popular uprising, really very popular. Thousands and dozens of thousands of people took to the street and demonstrated and protested for democracy, for their rights, for their local interests, etc. in 2008. So it was the year after. The third one was in 2011, where more than 100 towns in Morocco, it was the widest in the Arab world, the number of towns who participated. 105 towns and the big cities participated in the uprising of 2011. But just 2 years later, 10 towns participated in the scandal protest. Do you know the king of Morocco amnested a child abuser, Spanish child abuser, a criminal who was sentenced by Moroccan justice to 30 years in prison because he abused 11 children. Beginning in 2 years, some children were not more than 2 years old, and they were abused by this man, and he was amnested by the king just 2 years after he was in prison. These people, for the first time, some people, they aren't really politicized, they aren't activists, took to the streets and participated in huge protests in Morocco. And this obliged the king, for the first time in the history of Morocco, to ask implicitly for pardon from the people. And he published 3 communiques in 4 days. This was also the first time. So internet really is using, because of internet, because of lacom.com, the newspaper, the electronic media of Ali and Ouzla, participated in disseminating the call for protests and showing to the population this decision of the king. The two facts, so we have only two minutes and we will finish. State media in Morocco declared 1 day before the protests of the Arab Spring in Morocco that the organizers canceled the protest. Imagine that the whole media, state media, declared in television more than one time and even interviewed some leaders of the movement. That they say that, the movement is cancelled, there will be no protest tomorrow, etc. But think to social media, to internet, we could, avoid the failure of this protest, and hundreds of thousands of Moroccans participated in 2011 to the pro-democracy, protests. The last event was the first press conference organized by the 20 February movement before the 20 February protest, 3 days before. State media boycotted it, but we got a lot of journalists and a lot of civilian activists and social media reinforced the impact of this press conference and we could, it was organized in Rabat, and we could have this Arab Spring in Morocco. If there was no social media, there would have been no protest in Morocco because the state media told us that the movement was cancelled. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we're going to go back to the subject, and I think we want to have discussion, open discussion, and open question and answers over the fundamental question. So what we've heard from Richard and George is that ultimately what we're seeing, even though it seems that the Arab Spring has entered into an era of difficulty, that actually the revolutionary waves are likely to continue and intensify and become more quick in the future. We've also heard, and I think we can debate and argue, that the internet is still quite central to the possibility both of starting revolutions, but also finishing them, understanding how we can self-organize on a global scale in the 21st century. But I think what we don't have at this current moment, and we have good examples in Tunisia, half of revolution Morocco, we have the courageous example of WikiLeaks fighting against the most powerful oppression of the United States and other governments, but what we don't have is we don't have a common vision, we don't have a common strategy, and we still are not sure exactly how our tactics can move beyond simply overthrowing governments and move into sort of creating new forms of self-organization which can sustain revolutionary movements and sustain whole new forms of decentralized and autonomous societies, what the rights that we all want and the dignity that we all need. So I'd like just to ask people in the audience, because you've listened to us and put up with electricity turning off and on, about this.
Yeah, but I had a small comment on what you were saying. Actually, what George said, it's not that we have revolutions more often. What he said is that the spread of revolution is quicker, so in time.
Yes.
And this is really important because it's the direct impact of the internet on what was happening. And what actually Richard was saying is the momentum that we need is to have a revolution on the whole earth at the same time. That would overthrow, if we there is no bad guy anymore, anywhere, to save his own boat, like he said, we will win eventually, because the system is sustaining himself because there's always a bad guy somewhere that is still there. So you overthrow one bad guy here in Tunisia, but the other bad guys are over there. They will get back in place. If we could overthrow everybody at the same time.
There you go.
Yeah, and that's what he was saying, because what he was saying it was exactly that the revolution are spreading faster. So the next revolution eventually will be the same day in like 50 countries,
right.
You see? And the one after will be the whole world in 1 second. So, and this is possible, I think, but because what also Richard said is the instantaneous aspect of the internet. We were talking before about that fact, is that the Tunisian revolution is special in the fact that we were not organized. So the internet permits this. You don't have to be organized. You just need to be synchronized.
You don't need a party or...
You don't need to have a hierarchy. You don't need to have processes. You don't need anything. You just need to know what everybody is doing at every moment. And that's what the internet is. So you get synchronized. This guy is doing this. Okay, I will support him. I don't have to ask to ask him to do that. I just support him in the way I feel. You see, and once we will have that momentum over the internet, as once we have the the amount of people necessary on the internet. So this is the first trick. We need to have an inclusive internet to have everybody synchronized on the planet. Once we have that, eventually, at some moment in the future, it will happen anyway. So the question would be what we will do when it will happen. So anybody has an answer to that?
Yeah, we have lots of people. So on du trois, Sophie, we
only had male speakers.
Well, we know, that's why we're going to let her speak. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, man. So why don't you go?
Currently based is Delhi, and we saw internet playing especially Facebook and Twitter playing a huge role in bringing the current state government in place. And even to communicate with the current government, we use mediums such as Facebook and Twitter updates to tell that this is the move we like, this is the move we don't like, and there is a huge surge of volunteers which are there for party, against party kind of a thing. And so there's a lot of churning happening on the ground, but what is important, and some of us have been discussing back home in India, is this, that these social media like Facebook and Twitter are again controlled by the capitalist forces, and again in the United States. So there is a line of caution. Even if everybody on the planet Earth comes on web, you never know when our actions get controlled. So how do we have to strategize from the beginning to go in for open source kind of platforms, and what more can be created?
Why don't we do a few questions all at once? Any women? If not, we go to the next.
Yes,
there is a
little bit of
okay,
you go then.
Okay, thank you. My name is Osman, I'm from Turkey. And Gezi movement was forgotten to mention. I would like to mention that. And from the very beginning I was in that. It was spontaneous, autonomous, as you said. And the people, however, important thing is that people who were in Gezi, I wouldn't call them activists. They were ordinary people. Many of them were very apolitical. I mean, they didn't even care for voting or anything. But they were disturbed with the pressure of the rather oppressive government. And so it was incredibly spontaneous. There was not one single dictator like it happened during Arab Spring, that people can direct their focus. But spontaneously it started. So, and internet, of course, social networks were very helpful for it to start and grow. However, I doubt if I agree with the claim that it can finish it also. Sustainability is, I think, still an issue, and solidarity, universal, so global solidarity I'm talking about, is still an issue, and I don't think it will be just a fate that one day in 50 countries people will just uprise. I doubt that's the truth. I think it will be, in the end, as a result of solidarity, global solidarity, and a better, more focused agenda, I would say. That's my opinion. I wanted to share that based upon my Gezi experience. Thank you.
A tool of change. I think I'm not agree with you, Slim, because if we use internet as a mean of communication between people, we need to behind to have an organization that can have a clear strategy to make change. We cannot just speak with people with no hierarchy, and you will need you will be attending for change. Because I will give some example. For example, in Spain, there was the Indigenous movement, but then they have so much manifestations in the street, but at the end of the process, they have the right party in the government, and they are changing the thing because they found Podemos. So if you don't have organization, you cannot have exact decision on the exact change that you need. You are not the master of what will happen when a government came and changed the thing how he see the things. Thank you.
I just want to take 1 minute to respond to your question. So I think it is true, and it is dangerous that most of the social media large companies, Facebook, Twitter, also Google, as Assange's book points out, are effectively very centralized. They're increasingly centralized, and they are all based in the United States. So however, we should also remember that earlier in the days of the internet, that we had many different kinds of email communication, that before Gmail, before Yahoo Mail, before Live, that there was many different email servers, that many people used local email servers. You had activist email servers, and you still have activist email servers like RiseUp. And what I am working on personally, and if we have any computer hackers in the room, it'd be nice to discuss more, that the World Wide Web Consortium is working on a decentralized social networking working group to allow different social networks, not just Twitter and Facebook, but for you and your own social network, for you with your own software, for you and your own email, to communicate with each other in a decentralized way, with the goal eventually to sort of what Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the internet web, says is there's always a funny joke, is that to sort of re-decentralize the web. And I think to re-decentralize the web, while it's a hard engineering task, it's possible, and it's also politically necessary. But I want to make one little comment. A lot of people who support the re-decentralization of the web, they want to see the internet and web decentralized into national control. So you have the Chinese with the Chinese internet, Pakistan with the Pakistani internet, Brazil, even after passing Marco Seville, raided some local activist servers, the Brazil with the Brazilian internet. And this is all very dangerous because I think, as Richard and George point out, international solidarity requires international communication. And the internet is the best tool we have for international solidarity. And so we want to decentralize the internet, but to decentralize it into the hands of the people, not into nation states who just want to use the internet to surveil and control their own population. So we want to take it away from the NSA, away from the American corporations and their over control, but to put it into local hands, into activist hands, and to really decentralize the internet. And if you want to work on this technically, talk afterwards. And we have some questions, but maybe we should go to answer some of the, do three at a time. Just wait a second, three at a time. Do the two questions at a time, and then we go back, if you don't mind.
I have some answers, yeah, if you don't mind. Okay, about the subject of the Facebook and the fact that the social networks are centralized and what to do about it. Like Julian Assange said, anyway, we have to cope with it, because the only efficient means of activism we have is technology. So the thing is, we have technical solutions. The problem is not technical solution for decentralizing the internet. The problem is the implementation. The problem is Facebook has all your friends already. So, and here where enters the hacktivism, the hacking. You know that Facebook imposes the fact that you use your real identity. That's their real identity policy. You know how Tunisian people use Facebook? It's Hello, do you have a Facebook account? I need one. I give you my password. Okay, so it's a one account for a whole family and friends and etc. And Facebook don't even know. Facebook people are always surprised when I say this. Or they say, that explains a lot of things about what's happening in Tunisia. So, and this is a minimal hacking. Don't use their policies. Ignore it. Use pseudonymous. Make pseudonymous look like reality. Don't use your real name. Use a photo of someone else. Hack accounts of some other people, etc. And extract information from their system. They forbid it, but do it. Okay? At some moment, we will use Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google as platform to extract all the data that's already there and to build another social network. So we'll push them out. So it's okay to use them now, but be conscious that there are some people that are hacking into this platform, and support them. Don't buy the discourse that says those are, thieves or whatever. And the second thing about solidarity, the question that was raised, is it possible to have solidarity and how? And the fact that the internet is not enough. My experience of the Tunisian revolution is that you have to be inclusive. Not everybody is at the same level of activism. And you have to include everyone. The guy who is simply able to click like on Facebook, it's okay. Because it's the first step. It overcomes fear, and then when he will be ready to go to the riots in the street, he will do it. When he will be ready to confront the police, it's the next step, and he will do it. So you have to think of all of this as a spectrum of possibilities, and you have to fill. We try to fill in every possibility to make everyone included with its own capacities of activism. And eventually we succeeded in this by thinking in this way. So we have people that already did like, but are not able to confront the police. So let's create an event for them, which is simpler than confronting the police in the, you see, this way of thinking. And I think it works. And the last thing, the question about organizing. So I think that organizing is an intermediary state. I'm from the Pirate Party, so I'm organized. Okay, why are we are organized in the Pirate Party? Because we think it's not the time for complete system. The world didn't reach the state where everybody's synchronized and everything works by itself with no control. Okay, so till then you need to have tasks, and those tasks and those organizations do not need to be constrained by the old way to create organizations. So they could enable the future. I don't know if it's clear. You can't have an organization which is hierarchical, because it will get overthrown in the future when we will not need. It will not adapt to a future where there is no organization. So the trick is to have organizations for specific tasks, like, for example, for the Pirate Party, getting into the parliament and creating the laws. That's our task. And be in contact with other actors in the civil society and be embedded within. So you have double face. It's an organization with a task for one task. You see, you need organizations, but not in the old way of thinking of organization. You need an organization that when the task is done, it disappears.
Okay. I'd like to answer your question. Yes, organization is important, especially if we're going to organize a new world. And the internet enables us to organize a new world from the bottom up by federating all kinds of local initiatives. So there's two forms of organization. One is the pyramid, like a corporation, like a totalitarian state. It's decision making from the top down, okay? And we have here a Bob Avakian, who is the maximum leader of a world party, who has a formula and a plan and an organization to take over the world. But this is no different than the Maoists and the Stalins that we've already seen created new forms of totalitarianism. The other form of organization is the bottom up, and that's the network. And it starts with, for instance, neighborhood committees and neighborhood assemblies. Soviets, that's the workers' assemblies, and all different forms of horizontal organization, which then federate, so that they're able to communicate on a worldwide level. It seems to me that, for example, a worldwide economy could be organized that way. And exchanges could be made between countries that produce one thing and countries that produce another. So where people take over their lands and their fields, they can then use something like what is that thing where you buy and sell online? You know the...
eBay?
eBay, yes. eBay is a perfect example...
Or Silk Road.
...of how people can exchange at real values, not commodities, not merchandise, but the product of their labors against the product of other people's labors that they need. And another example that we have now is Wikipedia. It's true that people are at very different levels of scholarship and intelligence. This man knows more about Korea than anybody living, probably. But you see, through Wikipedia, everybody contributes the little part that they know, and we get a whole that is greater than the sum of its parts. So why not have a world constitution that's written that way by everybody contributing? Right now, there's a party in Spain, that left-wing party, and I saw on their website that they're asking their members to contribute in, and they're going to create their party program. Not just Bob Avakian or Stalin or somebody says, this is the truth, and then it changes and they shoot you and you forget to change fast enough. No, it's built up from the bottom up. So organization does not have to be this way. It can be this way.
Okay, so just quick.
I heard that in the United States, some people are already creating a Wikipedia about infrastructure. So the idea is about like Wikipedia, you can put the whole data online to do the same infrastructure. So like when it's a revolutionary time, well, everybody okay, with like we need some change, but how to get the infrastructure working? Like how to get a hydroelectric company keep working, and how to do to like prevent an explosion of a radioactive firm? You know, because all these kind of questions are very important for the life to come after, you know, the insurrection, and so that's probably the trust I put in the internet. Not probably for everything, but maybe for this kind of tools. That's all.
We had some small up here.
I just want to explain why the translator is gone. Actually, the translator, she received an SMS. Translators are right now in strike because one of them got mistreated, and in solidarity with him, they got in on strike. So all the translators are now in strike.
Not
so
mistreated by us.
Yeah,
I mean, we were mistreated by whoever hates Julian Assange and decided to turn our electricity off. But so we have some more questions and comments. So yeah, right. And then yeah.
Can you hear me?
Well,
Okay.
Now, I just mentioned, by the way, I am a member of the Finnish Pirate Party and was a candidate in the Euro elections, but that's not important. I wanted to add something to what you said about decentralization. I think we also need to think about the decentralization of the infrastructure of the internet. It is not enough to think only of the services of internet like World Wide Web. And I live in a rural area 70 kilometers from the Finnish capital Helsinki, where the people themselves, the peasants who live there, have built their own fiber optic cable networks. And this is not unique. You have in various countries this kind of local, very active intervention in the, actually in the field of telecommunications. But this is an extremely important thing, because one of the very big problems of the centralization of internet is, of course, that the telecom companies which have integrated with this, Googles and Amazons and so forth, they have centralized the internet. And the telecom business is actually quite unnecessary when we have fiber optic cables, and it can be very localized. The problem is that people do not think so. People tend to think that this is very, very difficult and technical, but actually it can be done locally, like people can make water provision cooperatives, and like people also created the telephone networks at the beginning. They were cooperatives. We have somehow to come back to this, because otherwise we cannot decentralize the internet. The internet has to be run at the level of the fiber optic cables by cities, by, for instance, libraries, this kind of institutions. Thank you.
Online democracy. And the second part about democracy is, well, this is an old term. I know here in Tunisia the concept of democracy emerged quite recently, but in other European old countries, democracy is an old-fashioned concept. And how do we hack this democracy? Because we see, for example, Greece. Greek people voted for a program and a party. This party came into power, but still the European Union said, okay, you voted, you elected them democratically, but now we decide for you. So how do we hack these old models through the internet, notably?
We're going to end soon, but we're going to respond to all the final comments and questions. We have any more comments and questions that we missed, because I'm sorry there's hands and I can't remember everyone. So anything else or no? Okay, so.
Could you just repeat the first question?
How to guarantee the access to internet?
Yeah, the access to the internet. You know that I've been often asked this question in the case of Tunisia, for example. We have like 35% access of the internet in Tunisia. And when we present our program of removing the parliament and having people vote directly, the first question is, how do you guarantee access? And I say that, you know, in Tunisia, like in mostly every country of the world, we have roads that are subsidized. So there is no reason that the fibers are not subsidized. There is no reason that the internet access in general, especially if it's used for democracy, could not be subsidized. It costs a lot less than the roads that are that they are building. And now there are new technologies like the ones Google have with the balloons, etc., which cost even less, and and it is even possible to put them in the Sahara or where we want. So again, the technology is ready. Now we need the political will. And for the second question about Greece and how to hack a democracy in established democracies, I think the way they're doing it in Greece is the right way. Now the problem is with the balance of power, of course. But you know, Iceland hacked it too. They said, "We won't pay. You can do nothing to us," and they succeeded. So it's a matter of negotiating and a matter of acquiring one right at a time and advancing the democracy towards the right way. But of course, it's not very quick. But it works. It's already working in Europe.
Well, depends which kind of democracy you're speaking about, because apparently there are a lot of people that we have here about the politics in Europe.
Like they are for dictatorship, or I don't know, like, you know, like restraint of their freedom, but maybe it's time to imagine some new kind of democracy. I don't know.
That don't move are irrelevant because they're not with you and they're not against you anyway. So the fight is between people that are willing to fight. Anyway, those people will move where anybody will win. Anyway, so don't care about it.
I wanted to come back to the question of the capitalists owning Facebook and other sites. It's not only that. We saw today, graphically, that when we tried to present Julian Assange, suddenly there was no electricity. And then he's gone, the electricity comes back on. I was in Xinjiang, China, northwestern China, in 2009 when there was a Uyghur, a Turkish uprising. And I tried to reach my friends. All of the internet was down, all of the cell phones were cut off, all of the communication networks were gone. And it's not that it's a capitalist ownership, it's that centralization. That's why the brother from Finland had a very good point. Decentralizing the technology itself, and I would also say bringing it under our ownership. It's not that expensive. We can have our own autonomous internet structures.
Yeah.
The technology is there, the resources are there.
But we still have to fight for the Atlantic cables.
Yes. Yes.
So there will be a big
and you know this
fight.
Is but I think developing alternative institutions. Another person said, how can we sustain struggles? Well, a part of the way is we have our own institutions that are physically resourced places where people can meet. As consciousness grows that we should stay in Tahrir Square, we should stay in Gezi Square, as more and more tens of thousands of people refuse to go home, the government can do nothing. This happened in South Korea in 1987, 19 consecutive days of illegal protests involving hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people. In Nepal in 2007, there were 59 consecutive days of illegal protests involving tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people. As people's consciousness of our power in the streets grows, we can sustain such struggles using our alternative institutions, our alternative technologies. You're looking skeptical, Slim.
No, not at all.
Don't forget the umbrella revolution
but yes, I would say one final thing. I asked the question, how can we across the world sustain our uprisings? My answer would be using the internet to build a common vision,
yes,
of plural realities so that people, for instance, here in Tunisia would say, we want this kind of society. And people in neighboring Libya might have a completely different vision.
Or
but they or Morocco. They should, you know, all of these visions as a wiki vision for the world could then be what people all over the world, when we are in the streets again, are saying, look, we have a solution. We don't need the WTO. We don't need the IMF. We don't need the World Bank. We don't need war. Right? We don't any. So if we have a common vision, I think that gives us something we can unite in the fight for.
Okay,
You want to say something?
You want to say anything final? No. Okay, so we're gonna wrap up because we're running a bit over. I mean, I just want to return to what George said and what Richard said. Do you have anything final? Okay, so I think one of the important things about WikiLeaks, which is often forgotten, is the wiki component. So right. WikiLeaks, when it was supposed to happen, when it was conceived by Assange, there was imagining that there would be these mini leaks, and there would be many people from all over the world coming to find the important leaks, to edit them, to translate them. And this all happened to some extent, but I think that's the part of WikiLeaks, which is, I mean, as Snowden shows, we know we can have leaks today. We're going to have more and more. But what's important is to bring together the collective intelligence to not just to process some corruption scandal, but to actually think through how can we create the new kind of society that we want. So that the editing, the collective intelligence brought through by the internet is not just limited to editing Wikipedia or to even leaking new sorts of valuable information, but to really what are the really revolutionary and practical questions that we do not solve, and that unless we solve, we will always, after revolution, have a new dictator, a new government, a new democracy that doesn't give us freedom. And that's, I think, the important thing about WikiLeaks and the Power Party is not to get too obsessed about the details, but to think, what is the next form that that WikiLeaks could take? What is WikiLeaks 2.0 for our era? Maybe it's something around infrastructure and logistics. Maybe it's something around letting people self-organize at the same time throughout the globe. Maybe, we don't know. But the important thing is that, and there will probably not be in the future, a single person or even a single small group of people that know, but that collectively the entire planet can solve these problems. And that will be, I think, the ultimate legacy of the Arab Spring and of WikiLeaks to the world, to start the spark which then eventually takes over and creates the new form of society. And the last thing I wanted to point out is that, you know, the World Social Forum is really important, but for the future, we are engaged right now in a battle against the NSA, against a lot of authoritarian governments who want to control the internet, and that a lot of it is actually coming to a head this year. And this may not be the most revolutionary, forward-thinking battle, but we have to defend the internet we have and make it more open and free and re-decentralize. So if people are interested in this, there is the Internet Social Forum had a meeting yesterday. There will be a Internet Governance Forum meeting in Brazil in the fall, which will be one of the more larger events for the future of the internet. And we have lots and lots of mailing lists and wikis and Twitter and Facebook groups that people should join now to get involved, because really, this next year and this next year or two, maybe the year or two, that determines the future of the internet, either as a system of social control ran by a few companies and authoritarian governments, or infrastructure for a possible liberated future. So thank you all for coming. I think we are finally done. Thank you. You should have. If you are on Twitter, tweet at WikiLeaks. They do check it, you know. Thank Assange for coming, because he turned off. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was great. I actually think that was an attack. That's the
brother,
second time.
Brother.
Hello. In Germany, of course, because you have these...